This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Feminist Fridays. I'm Chua Entek in for Juliet Jacobs. In a run-up to the war in Iraq, Mary Ann Wright, a retired U.S. Army colonel and former diplomat, publicly resigned from the U.S. State Department in direct protest of the 2003 invasion. Since resigning, patriotism for Ann Wright has meant becoming an anti-war activist, and she has cheerfully referred to herself as a felon for peace. She joins me now to share more about her life, both pre- and post-resignation. And thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So you were an active duty soldier for 13 years, and you spent another 16 in the Army Reserves, retiring eventually as a colonel. Why did you join the Army?
Well, like so many young people in the United States anyway, and perhaps here in Malaysia too, I wanted to get away from something. It wasn't I wanted to go kill anyone, but I wanted to get away from the state of Arkansas, where I grew up. Right. Although I had a wonderful family and enjoyed growing up there, I wanted to go travel. And my family didn't have money to send me out on a senior European tour or anything like that. But I needed to find some way to travel. And the Army came through town, joined the Army, see the world. And this was during the Vietnam War. But they said, since you're not a nurse, you won't be going to Vietnam. You'll get to go to Europe. And it was like, that's what I want to do. So I joined up thinking I would stay for 2 years. And I ended up having very interesting jobs, non-killing jobs, I'll say.
You wanted to go to Vietnam initially?
I did not want to go. No, I did not want to go to Vietnam. I wasn't an anti-war activist at that time. And looking back on it, it's been very interesting to kind of reconstruct my political attitudes then. I guess I was kind of apolitical in a way. And yet that was during the time where so much of America was roiled in an anti-war feeling. But I was in little Arkansas. And looking back on it, I don't really remember any anti-war marches that were going on around me. So I joined the Army to see the world. I went to Europe and enjoyed that, of course, and then ended up staying many more years in Europe as a civilian, then joining up with the Army again, staying in the reserves. And before I knew it, I'd spent 29 years in the Army.
How would you describe that process? Was the Army training fun?
No, it wasn't fun. Army training is not fun. However, it does develop a camaraderie with the people, the women that you're going through the training with. So it was, as you endured the hardships as a team, you develop friendships, and that's the way you get through things. And that's still what it is in the military today, that young men and women are going through some very horrific times in the military, and yet they stay in it, loyal to their friends, their buddies, the people they're in their platoon with. They may not agree with policies even, but they hang in there because they don't want to let their friends down.
Right. And what were you doing in Europe?
Well, at that time, this was in the late 60s and early 70s, the women in the military could only be nurses or in administrative jobs. There were no combat jobs at all that were open to women. So mine were administrative jobs, very interesting ones. My first assignment in Europe was at an international command with seven national militaries there, and they had a school for the kids of all of these militaries. And I ended up being the logistics officer for a school, a civilian school, which was an odd military assignment. And I also was responsible for all of the recreational facilities for this seven nationality command. So the gymnasium, the swimming pool, the arts and crafts, all of that. So it was kind of like having a civilian job in a way.
Was this a base camp? You were managing the logistics of a school in a military camp?
It was military dependents, kids, and it wasn't actually on a base. They had leased a school facility outside the base that we then supported logistically.
Right. Are you able to say which countries were you based in?
I was in the Netherlands when that happened, and then I also had various tours in Germany and also in Panama. I was also at many bases in the United States, too.
So when did that change, when women are only allowed to be nurses or administrators? When were they also recruited for combat roles?
Well, the combat started in the 1990s. It's kind of a recent, so to speak, in the last 20 years. I joined the military almost 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. I'm 70 years old right now. At the time, back 50 years ago, it was administrative and nurses, and then they started opening up different kinds of jobs, military intelligence, quartermaster, transportation, still more on the administrative side of things, but giving a little bit better opportunity in many fields, like military police, but not the combat arms like infantry or armor, field artillery, things like that, that I wouldn't have wanted to be in anyway.
So when you first joined the military, what was the, I guess, the male-female ratio like, and how is it today in comparison?
Well, back in the late 1960s, less than 1% of the U.S. military forces were women. So there were very few women in the military, and it was very difficult because, it was purely a total male environment. And as you can imagine, there was all sorts of sexual harassment, and you really had to be a strong person to withstand some of the stuff that was thrown at you. There were incidents of sexual assault, too, the numbers of which we're just now finding out about, because at that time, women were not telling anyone if they were sexually assaulted while they were in the military. Now they are, thank goodness, because we need to provide help for the women and men who are sexually assaulted in the military.
Yes, there's something that I definitely want to go into later on in this conversation, but how would you describe your rise through the ranks in the military?
Well, I was rising in the ranks at the normal rate. I didn't have a stellar career,
Did anyone try to put you down or give you a hard time because of maybe because of your gender or for other things, for other reasons?
Oh, sure. I mean, there were always rivalries with people that were your same age, or same rank. And many times within a command, in order to get a promotion, you have to be a little bit better than somebody else. So it encourages great competition and sometimes cutthroat competition. So at times there would be people who were willing to put down other people and willing to undercut the careers of someone else for their own benefit. So that happens, I guess, in corporate life, too. So you have to develop some sort of strategy that you work to make sure you are doing the very best job that you can and that your supervisors recognize that and try to – any sort of cutthroat business that's going on for me, I tried to stay out of it and get away from people that were of that kind of mind because they can destroy – lots of people, to include themselves ultimately, and I didn't want to have anything to do with them.
And how common is it to have a female chief?
Well, in those days, it was not common at all. Women were not supervisors unless they were in all female units. Then they would be the commanding officer of those units. Over time, women started rising in the ranks of some of the other military occupations, for example, in the quartermaster or in the transportation corps. And as they would rise a little bit higher and get to a rank where they could actually command a unit, by the mid-1970s, you were starting to see some women that were getting to be the executive officer of a unit. And then by the late 1970s, they could be the commander of a unit as a lieutenant colonel. And then by 2000, and that was actually after I had retired from the military, that's when you started seeing a lot of women in the military. Right now, the U.S. military is about 16% women. So statistically, then there would be more women who would be able to rise in rank and hold the positions where they would be commanding units that would have men in them. We do have women that have reached the general officer rank and several women who have been at four-star generals.
How did it happen, these incremental changes?
Well, part of it happened because the U.S. military was running out of men to go into the military. After they developed the all-volunteer force, after the draft was thrown out as the Vietnam War ended, the all-volunteer force did not attract enough men to fill all of the positions. And so they started expanding the limit on the number of women that could be in it. In fact, they totally threw away this 1% level that they had. So now all the military services will have – the Marines have the fewest at 8% and the Air Force at 17% have the highest. But during this time where the increase in the number of women in the military happened, we had to do some battling within the military as some of the very macho male senior policymakers were trying to keep women out of certain jobs that they had risen to the rank, they had the experience, and in units that they should be able to command, all of a sudden those units were being closed to them. And so we had to go in a very public way to embarrass the military to let women keep moving up in rank. So that was a major job. In fact, I ended up helping by creating an organization called Women in the Military that we had at several military bases where women would get together once a month, have lunch together to talk over what was happening on the military base they were assigned and who was having trouble in their units, either sexual assault, sexual harassment, or not being able to be promoted into positions of leadership, and knowing full well that it was solely because they were women that they weren't getting those jobs. So we kind of formed a little union, a union of women in the military, to go to the senior leadership and demand that things change. Well, needless to say, that did not go over well with a lot of the unit commanders. I mean, how could you have these women meeting at lunchtime to talk over what's going on the military base? That's undercutting the chain of command. And we would have to back up, say, there's a reason we have to do this because you guys aren't listening to us. You're sidelining us. You're not letting us get promoted and have the opportunities that you've had.
My guest today is Anne Wright, a retired U.S. Army colonel and former diplomat. She resigned from the U.S. State Department in 2003, protesting the invasion of Iraq. I'll ask her about that episode as well as this culture of harassment in the military after this short break. You're listening to BFM 89.9. You're listening to Feminist Fridays. I'm Troy Intek in for Juliet Jacobs. On the show today is Anne Wright, a former diplomat who resigned from the U.S. State Department to protest the 2003 invasion of Iraq. I'll come to that in a bit. Before the break, you alluded a little bit to the frequency in how cases of harassment happens in the military. I read that in 2003, a survey of female veterans found that 30% said they were raped in the military. And a year later, in a 2004 study of veterans who were seeking help for post-traumatic stress disorder, found that 71% of women said they were sexually assaulted or raped while serving. Well, two questions here. One is this reflective of your time in the military? And also, do studies or publicity like this make it harder for the military to recruit more women?
Well, as it turns out, there were a lot of sexual assaults that were going on during the period that when I first joined the military, except I didn't know about it. I didn't realize that this was going on because the women who had been sexually assaulted were so embarrassed and so traumatized that they didn't tell anyone. And it's only been after they are, for example, my age, that maybe they're going to the Veterans Administration Hospital for medical help on other subjects, and all of a sudden the remembrances of these horrible incidents have come back, and they have now asked for assistance for the psychological damage of what had happened to them. In the last 10 years, we've made great headway in providing an environment for young women and young men, because it's not just women that are getting raped. Men are getting raped too. And I mean, the military, I would call it a predatory organization. It's a predatory organization because people can get away with doing these criminal acts because other people will protect them. And that predatory organization has now, as you mentioned in these statistics, a very solid statistic is that 1 in 3 women in the U.S. military have been sexually assaulted or raped during the time that they were in there. Over the past 10 years, the numbers of men that have reported being sexually assaulted are 10% of all of those who've been reported, 10% of them are men. And if you think it's difficult for a woman to go to the chain of command, many times it's somebody in that chain of command that's actually been the perpetrator of the rape because they are, you know, they are senior in rank. They know that they've got kind of the life of that person in their hands because of the way the military is structured. Sometimes if they're in Afghanistan and Iraq, they can say, you can be dead tomorrow. You'll just be a combat casualty. Nobody will ever know what happened to you if you dare tell anybody what happened, that you could be dead tomorrow. So the issue of sexual assault is a very major one that we now have gotten the U.S. Congress involved in it. And a lot of women, congresswomen, have really taken the military to task on this, which we are very proud of those women to come to our aid in helping women in the military.
Yeah, because even now they're discovering all these private groups where male service members are sharing naked images of female service members. Do you still keep up with what's happening in the military, and do you see a change in the culture?
I do keep up with it, and I see no change in it because we're still having the same numbers of women and men each year reporting that they've been sexually assaulted. Even though the senior leadership of the military services claim that they have very strong programs against or to prevent sexual assault, the statistics are showing that it's not working. And when you look at incidents that are happening at our military academies, where young men and women are coming out of high school and going into these very prestigious military academies for their university training, we're finding that there are many instances of sexual assault at that very early stage of being in the military, as well as in units where young men and women are coming from high school, going straight into the military, doing their basic training and going out into various units, you find the same thing. So it is perplexing that you take young kids who are coming out of high school and all of a sudden they go into an environment where they feel they have the protection to be able to do these criminal acts.
As an outsider reading about U.S. news, I guess when you see things like the media personality Bill O'Reilly getting forced out because of the many sexual harassment allegations, as well as the former Fox chairman Roger Ailes, but then again during the presidential election, when you have a candidate bragging about sexual assault, it's such a vexed issue, isn't it? The sexual harassment is hard to prove, and victim blaming is so rampant. How do you even redirect the conversation from victim blaming to putting the onus on the other person?
On the perpetrator, yeah. Well, you're so right. And that Fox News organization that had so many perpetrators in it, and Bill O'Reilly and Roger Ailes, who are both of them such bombastic sorts of people who, by their own personalities, would try to silence any of these criminal acts that they've done. So
the modus operandi is very similar, isn't it?
Yes.
They threaten your livelihood and career.
Yeah. Well, and then you have Donald Trump. You know, who would have thought that a person who on tape convicted himself of sexual assault by what he told on this tape, and yet he became the nominee and ultimately the president of the United States. In other times, that would have knocked him totally out of the race. But for some reason, the environment that we're living in, he survived that and now became president of the United States, and now has his own war on women with all of the health care changes, the prohibition against abortions, taking away Planned Parenthood's non-abortion, women reproductive health rights. It's really a terrible time right now.
Well, let's switch gear a little bit and go back to 2003. Why did you resign then?
Well, I resigned because I could not accept the fact that the United States, under the Bush administration, was going to invade and occupy an oil-rich Arab Muslim country that had not attacked the United States, had nothing to do with 9/11, and had had a quarantine around it for 10 years since Gulf War I. I couldn't understand where this idea of weapons of mass destruction was coming from, since UN inspectors, most of whom were U.S. military or CIA operatives, they had searched that country from one end to the other, and what weapons were there, they destroyed them. So how the Bush administration could use this idea there were more weapons of mass destruction, and in fact, nobody believed them. I mean, you had the largest marches in the history of the world were held before the invasion and occupation. The UN Security Council refused to vote for war as the international community against Saddam Hussein because they didn't believe the intelligence briefing that Colin Powell, my boss as Secretary of State, had given them. The Coalition of the Willing joined in because the United States paid them to by increasing the amount of aid. And I know this for a fact because I was out in the U.S. Embassy in Mongolia, and we were told, go to the Mongolian government and tell them unless they join the Coalition of the Willing, we will take away all international aid programs, and we will, they'll suffer for it. They'll pay for it. And the Mongolians were very good. They kept the U.S. at bay for the longest time before they ultimately had to succumb to it. But that's when I told my ambassador there, I'm not going to go tell the Mongolians that. This is blackmail. And I had been doing a lot of writing about my concerns about the pending military attack, and that the volume of papers as I would get up in the early morning in these cold, cold Mongolian mornings, 40 below zero, it was freezing in my house, and I couldn't sleep. I was so concerned about what was happening, so I kept writing and writing and writing. And finally, it turned into what was my letter of resignation, where I talked about the war in Iraq and also the unbalanced policies of the United States on Israel and Palestine, the lack of effort in resolving anything with North Korea to capitalize on the gains that have been made during the Clinton administration. And then the last thing was the unnecessary curtailment of civil liberties under the Patriot Act. It turned out to be a 4-page letter of resignation. Later, people told me that was the longest one the State Department had ever gotten. But I figured I'd been in the government for 40 years, and they could at least have one page of dissent for every decade I'd been in there.
Well, you must have been very took a lot of courage, because I think a lot of the mainstream media at the time was for the war, even those that are considered traditionally liberal and left-leaning, they were for President Bush's war on terror, even though he was a Republican president. And what happened to your resignation letter, do you know?
Well, it was received by Colin Powell, and he apparently told members of his staff, write a letter to acknowledge we've received it. And so the story goes that the staffers wrote this very nasty letter essentially saying, good riddance to you. You can't figure this thing out. You know, goodbye.
Wow.
And they took it up to Colin Powell, and he went, no, this isn't what I want to tell her. Write it, you know, differently. That's just not it. They took another one up, and he didn't like that one. And then finally he said, just take down these words. Thank her for her service in both the State Department and the military and wish her well. And so that's kind of what came out. They didn't talk about the war itself.
Were you ever concerned that people would call you a traitor?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And did that happen?
Not really. Mm-hmm. It really didn't, because most, rather than getting emails saying you're a traitor, I got emails saying you're doing the right thing. I got hundreds of emails from colleagues in the State Department from around the world and embassies around the world saying, you're doing the right thing. This is a terrible decision to invade and occupy Iraq. So many Iraqis are going to get killed. The reputation of the United States is going to be in the trash bin again. It makes no sense, but I wish I could join you in resignation, but I've got kids in college, I've got mortgages. Financially, I just cannot resign. But the hundreds of people that there, three of us ended up resigning in the U.S. government, only three, but each one of us got hundreds of emails from colleagues all over the world saying, you're doing the right thing.
You know, you take out the detail about the war, and it seems like history is just repeating itself, isn't it?
Well, it is. It certainly is. And, you know, you just mentioned that the media was really gung-ho for the Iraq war. And you find the same thing in right now, where all of a sudden when Donald Trump sent 59 Tomahawk missiles into this tiny little air base in Syria and then dropped the largest bomb that the United States has, non-nuclear, onto this poor little area of Afghanistan, all of a sudden the news media that were railing about Donald Trump all of a sudden started loving him because he's a very powerful, he's willing, decisive, he's willing to use force against, you know, against what? You know, people that were living out in a cave, come on, you know. So, but the media, even the left-wing media started proclaiming Trump as acting very presidential.
But as a member of the armed forces and a diplomat, and now as a engaged civilian, you have said before that it's sometimes appropriate to draw on military force. When is it an appropriate time?
Well, that's right. That I had put in, I think, my letter of resignation or one of the early writings that I did. And looking on it now, I kind of regret that I put that in there, although there may be certain times that there's no other way to get around a situation except by using the military. But I would make the caveat that seldom do we reach that point, that the United States in particular never uses diplomacy and words to the extent and negotiations to actually try to effect a change without using the military. The U.S. is so likely to go ahead and just think, we just send in our military, that's going to solve the situation. We send in the military, we do regime change in Iraq, we do regime change in Libya, we do regime change in Syria, then everything's going to be fine after that. And we've seen, no, it's not. That use of that military force did not resolve the situation.
And part of your work in the Army was special operations and civil affairs, and it is what happens after the initial strike. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the U.S. Army has a large number of people, both primarily in the reserve component, but two units in the active military whose job it is to kind of be culturally sensitive to the area where these military operations are going on, that they should know the language of the area, they should know the culture, the governmental structure and all this. And they are prepared to go in and be a shadow government for a period of time until a government can be stood up in the place that the U.S. has just invaded, occupied, and destroyed the government. It's kind of a strange situation, isn't it? You go in and destroy something, and then you bring in your own people, similar to what we did in Iraq, where we had a U.S. proconsul that ruled the country for over a year, which was, and we saw how well that worked. That just didn't work at all. But indeed, I was part of this civil affairs branch, which is, I thought it was a very useful thing because it did at least acknowledge the humanity of the people that the U.S. government was going over to kill. At least we knew something about them and tried to explain to other military units what type of environment they were walking into or forcing their way into. It was a Well, a very interesting kind of an academic exercise in a way, that you knew so much about various parts of the world because your job was to study them and to write annexes for military operational plans that would, if they were read by the combat forces, it should alert them to a lot of pitfalls and ways that they might be able to work in that environment and not kill everybody.
Yeah, because I'm sure there's no shortage of Middle East expert or an expert on anything from the U.S. And so what gets lost in that chain of command when you're trying to translate that expertise into execution on how to rebuild? Why is nation building so fraught after the initial strike?
Well, I think part of it is that the people who are being occupied don't want want the occupiers in there doing the things that they are told they have to do, like set up a new government or help do an infrastructure. And the local civilians are going, we don't want you in here. You've torn up everything in our country, and now you're trying to rebuild it. Why didn't you try to negotiate something so that our lives wouldn't have had to be destroyed by military operations?
I think that's a very fair point. You are in Malaysia to speak about this woman's boat to Gaza. Can you tell me more about that?
Surely. I've been involved in Palestinian issues since 2009 with the Israeli attack on Gaza that killed 1,400 people in a 29-day attack, and then an attack in 2012, and then a large 51-day attack in 2014. We've been trying to challenge the Israeli attacks on Gaza through a unique international initiative, and that's called Boats to Gaza, where we challenge the illegal naval blockade of Gaza by sending boats filled with internationals to challenge their self-proclaimed security zone outside of Gaza. You know, Gaza, this tiny little place, 25 miles long, 5 miles wide, 2 million people live in that. It's one of the most densely populated places in the world, and the Israelis use that place as an experimental testing place where they test out weapons on human beings, where they control everything that goes into Gaza, the food, the electricity, the water. Everything is controlled. People in Gaza can't leave there unless the Israelis say it's okay, and most of the time they say they can't. We started sailing boats to Gaza in 2008, and you probably remember in 2010 there were six boats that were violently attacked by the Israelis, the Marvi Marmara, where there were 12 Malaysians plus two Malaysian film journalists that were on that. 9 people were killed, another one subsequently died, 50 were wounded. Well, the progression of these boats to Gaza, the last one was in 2016 in September, and that was called the Women's Boat to Gaza. It was the first time we had ever thought about putting just women on these boats, women as the captain, the crew, and all of the passengers. And we did it in solidarity with the women of Gaza, the women who kind of hold the families together under all of these pressures, all of these attacks that are going on, and all of the lack of supplies, the lack of food. It's the women that are holding the families together. So in solidarity with them, we thought this would be a good way to do it, to have an all-women's boat. So off we went from Barcelona, Spain, through Corsica and France, down to Sicily and Italy on a 1,700-mile voyage that ended at the last 1,000 miles ended 34 miles off Gaza, where the Israelis stopped and attacked us. And on board the boat, we had a wonderful woman from Malaysia, Dr. Fazia Hassan, the doctor for our boat. For 13 women, she tried her best to keep us as healthy as possible through thick and thin, through high seas, high winds, and lots of seasickness. But these 13 women were from 13 countries and all totally committed to solidarity with Palestinians and to raise the issue of why should Israel be able to get away with putting the people of Gaza in an open-air prison, imprisoning them in that little tiny area. So our boats are part of an international message to the Israelis and to the U.S. government that supports Israel and what it does to the Israelis or to the Palestinians in both Gaza and the West Bank. And this little tiny ship sending hope to people of Gaza, saying, you haven't been forgotten. We know what's happening to you, and we're sailing this little boat as a means to get publicity for what you are enduring. And indeed, the Malaysian press was really good. They followed that boat very, very well. And in the Middle East, we had a lot of publicity on it. In Europe, we had a modest amount. In the United States, we had absolutely zero, because the U.S. press will not cover anything that's challenging the state of Israel.
Speaking about that, recently when the Israeli Prime Minister visited the White House, I think President Donald Trump was indicating that he was willing to move away from that two-state solution. And you work in the State Department before. When you hear things like that and you don't agree with, if you don't agree with something, how do you move forward in a situation like that?
Well, it is very challenging, and I think the State Department's going to have its hands full trying to figure out what the Trump administration is doing. It already has President Trump himself in his tweets and his phone calls have already upset the traditional relationships with many countries. And they have already had to go back within this first 100 days of his administration to apologize to people. They don't call it an apology, but to kind of repair the damage done by his just off-the-cuff remarks. And on the issue of Israel and Palestine, his whole cabinet is pro-Israeli, as all American presidential administrations have been. But he is appointed as the U.S. ambassador to Israel, a fellow who has built buildings in the illegal settlements that have stolen land from Palestinians in the West Bank. And we have a U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. who, Nikki Haley, a woman. Here you have Feminist Friday. And let me just say that there are a lot of women who aren't representing, I think, the best of women and aren't protecting they aren't protecting women at all by their positions in government. So the Trump administration in particular has some notorious women that are a part of it. And Nikki Haley, as the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., has been totally supportive of everything Israel is doing to the Palestinians, to the point that it's just embarrassing to hear her talk.
Lots of work to be done then.
Yes.
And thank you so much for speaking to us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
This has been Feminist Fridays. You're listening to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.